The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on November 11, 2007. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to see you all. Last week we had our annual shake-up meeting. Once a year we gather to just discuss how we're doing things here, how are things going. And last week, Catherine brought up a concern about kids. You know, how do we relate to kids with our practice? Big question, and a serious one. And I thought I'd like to say maybe a little bit about that. I certainly won't exhaust it today. But I thought I'd say a little bit about that in view of Dogen Zenji's Tenzo Kyoken, his instructions to the cook. He speaks of three minds: joyful mind, kind mind, and magnanimous mind. Of course, these aren't exactly three minds. But that middle one, kind mind, Dogen says, to treat others or treat whatever it is, but you treat it as a parent would treat their child. So it's also called parental mind. And I've used that term on occasion when I've spoken of this. I think the problem is, and that this might have been kind of relating to a concern I felt that Catherine was expressing, that when we say parental mind, well then, sounds like I'm just talking about what the responsibilities of the parents are. We might think that, but that's not this at all, of course. This is really a responsibility for all of us. So we just can't push this off onto parents. So I want to speak of kind mind. It's also translated as kind mind, Roshin, kind mind. Of course, even there, I suppose, if we really got fixed on the definition of the word kind, it's related to the word kin. Those are of your kind. And we treat those of our kind with kindness. So maybe it still sounds like we're just talking family here. But really, this Roshin is a pervasive attitude and mind that one cultivates toward the world, toward everything. And certainly this matter of children, well, they're certainly a part of this world, and a big part of it, and an important part. So we should bear that in mind. But again, as I said, it's easy. You throw out a term or we look at it in a particular way, we get fixed on something. And we don't empty our cup, you know. I won't get into that story again, no, but you know, empty your cup. Even when we hear the story, empty your cup, we don't empty our cup and realize what empty your cup is referring to. This is our problem. We don't bring our mind back to reality and to what is really being pointed out here. We'll fix on a stylized form or an idea or a word will trigger something. We got it locked. Oh, okay, we got that pegged, and now we just go on, not realizing, particularly if we're looking at Dharma, considering Dharma, listening to Dharma, and you want to understand this kind of teaching and this practice, we're always talking about something living and dynamic, not something frozen that's been boxed up now for you in a pretty package that we put a label on. Okay, I know what that is. Now we set that aside. But this easily goes on with us because of our powerful minds, you know, our conceptualizing minds, wonderful as they are, and they are. It's a great ability that we have. It's truly a treasure for each one of us. But still, if we don't understand this, we easily abuse it. And we abuse ourselves and each other and everything as a result of this. So we have to allow things at least to be a little bit more fluid and open, as in fact things are in reality. But again, as I was saying, just, you know, some examples of how we might lock down. I remember, like, for example, in my book, Buddhism Plain and Simple, when that came out, I was shocked to find that people were relating to this as a book for beginners. That was not in my mind. I mean, sure, it's for beginners, but it's not limited to that. Maybe it's because I used the word simple in the title, which only referred to this as just simply what the Buddha taught. Kept it simple. I didn't compound it with other kinds of teachings. I wanted to focus on what the Buddha taught. But then people will lock on to that in various ways. Of course, then I've been also been criticized, well, this isn't simple. No, it's quite profound, actually. It really is simple, though, but it's profound, and it's not easy maybe to understand in its depth or to practice. But I didn't say that. But we'll lock on a word like that, we'll lock on a phrase, an idea, something we've heard before. Empty your cup, empty your mind. We just lock, okay, and we set that aside. We're no longer keeping that in our awareness as the moment is unfolding. So it's very easy for us to do. And sometimes, too, we won't just get the wrong idea or repackage it in our own translation, for ourselves. But sometimes we even begin to operate out of that. We think, oh, it means this, and pretty soon we'll frame it up in a particular way that might have nothing to do with reality or the way things were or the way something was spoken or presented. So we have to be careful. This would be empty your mind. Watch for that and realize when you've just thrown things into a frozen package. Because you can build something out of that and start to operate out of something just constructed now, out of your, I don't know, your imagination or your calculations or your, very often according to your own personal wants and cravings and desires and the way you would like things to be arranged, so you start to see it in those terms. Or we frame it off from ourselves and we're offended or angered or fearful of all that. So we create a great deal of trouble because we'll actually start building things out of this. Like I noticed on my walk, occasionally you see somebody running along the road. The road that goes around Lake Harriet. And except for that loop that takes you back up away from the bandstand there, it's pretty round, I suppose. Inside the road, then, is the bike trail. And then inside that, of course, is the walking trail. So I'm walking along the walk, and I've noticed this. You see runners running, say, along the bike trail at times, or there's paths up there. But then occasionally you even see somebody running along the road. I think, why would anyone run along the road? All the fumes of the cars and things that might be going by. Why run out there, And I surmise, I don't know, but I suspect it might be because we think, well, it's kind of like, when you buy a pizza, you add another inch to the pizza or two, you add a lot more pizza, much bigger area, So we're probably thinking, well, you get out to that outer ring and you're just that much longer, because you really want to get length in there. But of course, if we just knew some very simple arithmetic here, that lake is a mile across, basically, roughly. So the loop around it is roughly 3 miles, pi times, 3 and a 7, 3.14159 times a mile. So it's a little over 3 miles to run around the lake. And of course, but you go out a little bit further and we think, well, that's even further around. But the diameter, the circumference is just, C equals pi D. Pi times the diameter. All you've done, you got a mile across the lake. Now you've added a few more feet. And you multiply that by pi. So what? After you run around that outer ring and you're breathing all those fumes and everything, you've only run maybe an extra 60 feet by the time you've run around that lake. Well, maybe a little bit more than that. 100 feet, 120 feet maybe. It's not worth it, you see. But you see, we'll probably frame something up in our mind. We'll see it that way. Carried this over maybe from our experiences with ordering pizza or something, and we think, get a little extra jogging in there. When in fact you could have just jogged the far more pleasant walking path or the paths that are along the walking path, the dirt paths there. And in fact, I would say it's even a longer trek on the inside path, because the walking path meanders a bit. That's going to add length, you see. You get out to the biking path, it meanders a little bit, but not anywhere near as much as the walking path. And by the time you get out to the road, it's pretty circular. You know, it doesn't really wander at all. So you actually, if length is what you want, you probably do want to, I'm just letting you know in case you do want to jog. I'd like to get your people in off the road anyway. That's kind of dangerous out there as well. Well, my point, though, is that we'll quickly size up the situation, maybe wrongly, not paying careful attention. We think we've got it nailed down, and we'll actually start conducting our life out of that. We'll jog out there on that outer line. I mean, there's certainly nothing wrong with that. My point is, though, so often we are living out of a constructed reality that we've made that's really based on nothing at all, or based on error. And all the while we're doing that, we're not really looking carefully at what is actually going on, what our real concern is, or is what we're doing now, does it really match our concern, or, you know, address it in some way, or work with it in the way that we imagine that it is. Only when we actually come back to this moment and look at it in a living, dynamic way, as opposed to resorting to some formula, C equals pi squared. A equals pi r squared, C equals pi d. Better get my formulas down. But these things are handy, yeah, and there's a place for them. But if what we're dealing with now is just the everyday and the living dynamic reality of our life, you better be careful with things like that, because you frame this up, oh, this means that, or you have some pat explanation for things, or the way we've sized things up, or people up, or the situation up. If we haven't digested that and incorporated it in such a way where we're now looking at the living dynamic reality that's unfolding right here, it might not match this at all. Also, in doing that, we might begin to see just how it is that we do frame things out in our mind in that way, which actually is just delusion, really. It's what it is. Because however you frame it in your mind, it might be functional and useful in certain ways, but it certainly doesn't capture reality. The reality that we're living is in the dynamic reality of right here and right now. So when we speak of something like, say, parental mind, very quickly we just lock on to that. Or when the question of children, like as it came up in a discussion last week, immediately we just locked on to it in maybe kind of a familiar way of looking at this thing. What, Sunday school, having some kind of program, fixing something up for the kids and arranging that and whatever. And of course, along with that, we do bear in mind here, but we don't indoctrinate children here, or anybody for that matter. Offer this, people can come and take it and leave, or leave it. See it for what it is. But in the case of children, we better be very careful here, because children, especially as they are looking to adults, they're forming their world and their ideas, and their constructed reality is being formed right there, far more than it is for us. Well, us older folks, we just kind of are living in our old encrusted frameworks here, and it's hard for us to really budge out of those things, you know, which also isn't particularly healthy. Well, in the case of children, of course, this has to be that way. They do need to frame things up a bit. We were all children once, and our problem is that in these frameworks, whether badly made or well made or whatever, they do become kind of locked in. And our strong tendency is to act out of that rather than seeing the dynamic living reality that is unfolding right here. And Roshi, in this, I'm calling it now kind mind, maybe just to help us not to get too locked down. Along with joyful mind and magnanimous mind, there's your magnanimous mind is a mind that's including everything, taking in everything. As I said, these three minds, joyful mind, kind mind, and magnanimous mind, these are not three minds. even though we call them three minds, Sanshin, the three minds. And they're, yeah, we can speak of them as three, so three, yes, but not exactly three. Because if we really understand any one of these, we understand all three. And true understanding, according to Dogen, is that you're living it out. It's not just an idea, not just we can all have the concept, the idea of this. Now our cup is full, our mind is filled, we got some box there, and now we're ready to go on to the next distraction that we can get, you know, and not really notice what's actually happening, or even what this teaching is directing our attention to, which is always something living and dynamic, something that you actually can't get in your hands or framed up. Though a certain amount of this framing is functional, useful, but as long as you understand what that is, and it's never actually capturing reality, might be just temporarily helpful in a given situation. That's why we have our shake-up meeting in the first place. So we don't frame things up and box them in too tightly, shake them up once a year just to see what falls apart here, rattles out. Or maybe something else that needs to be, you know, brought in and looked at. So always, you know, leaving it in this kind of a fluid reality that this is actually our life. It's very dynamic in that way. And so we should be careful to watch our minds, to see to it that our minds remain flexible and tolerant and open and magnanimous. Then they can be joyful and kind. That is what should not be lost. And in particular, now, if we do come together to discuss this matter, well, children, how do we deal with children? Dogen, in speaking of Roshin, you know, kind mind, he talks about handling everything, just the instructions to the cook, you know, so you're talking about maybe handling the utensils or the cup. We handle that, Dogen says, you handle it as though you are holding your eyes in your hands. How would you handle your eyes, how valuable your eyes are, how wonderful they are, how sensitive they are, how careful we need to be with our eyes. Without even thinking something's coming, we might shield our eyes, block the eyes from the sharp light that suddenly bursts. Very quickly, without thinking, we, right there, that's parental mind, without thinking, immediately going toward taking care of this. But Dogen says, this attitude we extend to everything. As a very attentive parent, not locked up in their own petty little self now, of course, they'll see their identity extended into their children, so that's how they would react toward that particular child. It's their child. But Dogen is saying, he's speaking of a mind where we extend this into the world itself. We can do this if we realize that that is our life, the world itself. There's nothing here that is really cut off and blocked and separated from anything else. And to not care for this child, here's your favorite child, your child, and to not care for the other with the same attention only injures your own child. They see what you're doing, and that's going to set up needless injustices in the world. That's just going to cause strife and difficulty, anger and resentment. So to cultivate this Roshin, cultivating this mind that is seeing things, the magnanimous mind, seeing things in wholeness and in totality. And it is also a joyful mind. You know, it is, you know, your mind that is cut off, your mind that is preoccupied with self, if you ever look, it's not a joyful mind. You ever notice that? And when maybe momentarily you've forgotten yourself and you're really concerned about another, even for their happiness, have you ever felt that so often? Maybe somebody else's happiness or good experience leaves us feeling, oh, kind of, you know, for some kind of comfort. But how about when it's you actually are happy, joyful to see someone else's happiness? There's no other feeling quite like that. That is truly a joyful mind. And it is also a mind that is magnanimous. And it is also a mind at that moment that is kind. So what Dogen is speaking of here is drawing our attention to this, that there is such a mind manifested here, as we're speaking of it in these three different ways. And this is what we need to cultivate. So when we're dealing, well, with children or with anyone, bear this in mind. Now, just as you wouldn't want to be boxed in and forced to take up a particular creed or way of viewing things, we realize that, you know, whatever we're presenting to a child, very easily that is what will happen, because the child is framing things, building structure. They need to know. They need that. We have to be very careful in their presence. But if we are speaking with kindness and magnanimous mind, this is how we can train children. It's not training like framing and forcing, but it's actually something is coming out of, maybe we can demonstrate to them how to live a life of kindness and openness and joy and flexibility, fairness, justice, truthfulness. See, the thing is, like, we think we teach the children, oh, you shouldn't lie, it's bad to lie, you know, but that's not particularly helpful, particularly if they see you lying. And they do see that. You can't fool kids. So it's like, oh, this is what we say, but this is what we're really doing here, you see. That's what they see. They're not stupid. They can see what's happening. So if we are concerned with children, raising children, if we are concerned with letting them know, what do we do here, what do we learn here, what do we teach here, well, then we have to begin to practice this in their presence. Remember some years ago, I was asked to, I can't remember what kind of presentation it was, but I gave two of them actually over at Mount Olivet here. This is a big Lutheran church. In fact, I think it might be the largest Lutheran church in the United States. Is that right? Only a few blocks away. Wow. In fact, they asked me, how many people did you have, how many members here? And at that time, we were smaller than we are now, but I don't know, maybe we had 100 or so at that time. I can't remember. But they said, we have more Johnsons than that, they said. So, but anyway, but I was over there, and I guess I was just making kind of a general presentation about Buddhism. And then they had some questions. And they wanted to know, you know, what do we teach children? Do we have Sunday school and that sort of thing? Well, I told them, I said, the most important thing with children is, first of all, to let them be children. Let them play. I remember my own teacher, Katagiri Roshi, he used to say that the work of a child, the occupation of a child, is to play. That's what they do. That's their job, you might say. They don't get paid for it or whatever. Exactly, do they? Maybe later in life, you see. Because then maybe you end up with a well-adjusted child. So the payoffs are enormous. So just let them be a child. Let them play. But of course, they can't just let them play in a totally unbounded way, because they don't know enough. They can do things that will actually injure themselves directly or each other. So we watch them. And we watch them with Roshin, with this kind mind. As if we are as careful with them as if we would be with our own eyes. Becoming more sensitive to how is it that we can injure a child. Well, certainly, I mean, physically, that's pretty obvious. And we don't want to do something like that. Obviously. But what is just as bad, perhaps worse, we can injure them in their mind. Make them fearful, make them rigid, make them intolerant. Show them mixed messages. Yeah, you don't lie, it's bad, you're bad, but then I do it, you see. and leave them kind of confused and uneasy in their mind. So unfortunately for us grown-ups, we have an enormous responsibility, and not just to children, but really to each other. But in this case now, with other adults, they can maybe fend them for themselves a little bit better, but not entirely, you know. We really need to extend this mind. It's magnanimous, across the board, unbounded. But certainly when it comes to this matter of children, this is what we need to do. We need to demonstrate this. We need to live it. We need to show it. If honesty is what you want your child to learn, or any child to learn, or anybody to treat you with honesty, okay, then you yourself have to do this. And so this matter of Roshan then is a matter of constantly looking back at yourself, where our tendency is always to look out there. Yeah, and then we have a boxed up, framed up idea. We've got to do something now for children. And next thing you know, we're constructing some program and that sort of thing. And the next thing, maybe inadvertently indoctrinating them with one thing or another. So this is a very difficult thing for us. But if we understand our practice and our way, our teaching here, it is that for each one of us, we need to come back to look at our own mind, to look at our own practice. And we don't lose sight of that now, as maybe if we do. Go ahead. And I don't know if that will happen here or not, but if we do, go ahead and offer something for children. But the most important thing is that they play, and then we are there to watch them, give them a little guidance. You know, Billy hits Johnny because Johnny took his truck or whatever. Well, then we have to deal with that. Well, we can deal with it with Roshan. Kindness. Help Billy see that this is not the way to find joyful mind. They have to learn these things, these skills of just living life. And that is what is needed, far more than some kind of program, maybe teaching this or that, but of course maybe tell a story. But then if you tell the story, yeah, Aesop's fable's pretty good, maybe. But then you have the fox and the stork, was it? The fox serves something to the stork and the stork can't eat it because it has this long beak, you know. And then the stork offered something for the fox at the far, you know, that sort of thing. And kind of back and forth. I don't know. So you have to be careful there, too. Because what could be learned? Well, the fox wasn't being very nice to the stork, and the stork wasn't being very nice to the... Foxes are sneaky, and, so you have to be careful even there. Just realize what you're dealing with when you're dealing with a child. You're dealing with something fresh and wide open, and it can easily be boxed up and framed out in ways that can cause a great deal of injury. So what I told them anyway at Mount Olivet is that in our practice, in our way, we first give them freedom, and then we watch them, but most importantly, we watch ourselves. And not just in their presence. Our way, finally, is to just watch your own mind. All of this needs to be done with kindness, with Roshan. That means not with judgment, not with blaming, either to ourselves or to others, but with understanding, and an understanding that comes with this magnanimous mind, this broad mind that we allow to expand open and to embrace everything. With kindness, with the desire to heal the difficulty and the wounds and the misunderstandings and the anger and the injustice and all of that. And with joyful mind, it remains joyful if we just never get bound up in that ourselves. Not expecting that everything is going to always be hunky-dory, because it won't be. The human world is very complex and very difficult, and will always Well, for all practical purposes, we might as well say that we'll always have pain, suffering, confusion, hatred, injustice. But we can learn to have this magnanimous mind, this flexible mind, tolerant mind, open mind. And we can also realize that in doing this, this is the only way that we can transmit this to our children, is to demonstrate it, is to show it, is to live out of that ourselves. And then in that way too, we won't really indoctrinate. Because there isn't any particular thing, there's nothing particular here that I've given you saying that we must support this idea and hand that off and teach them about this, you see. I mean, if our value is honesty, and why? Because we just realize the wholesomeness and the peacefulness that occurs in the world with that, and the justice that follows with that. But that's not a particular thing, and there's no particular way to say, well, think this or grab hold of this or whatever. It's just simply in living out of that. And maybe from time to time, as they grow older and they can begin to comprehend more, we can offer a few words about that. And at times when we notice our own in our own life how we slip off following this way ourselves, that we acknowledge that. And certainly acknowledge that to others when we've done some injustice or whatever to them. So this really is to take care of children. So whether or not there's a program here or not, or whatever. Another thing too is like maybe we want to think that, well, we should teach them how we sit and what our meditation is and this sort of thing. Well, I'd be very careful with things like that. And what I'm trying to speak of here is anytime you get the idea, oh, we got to have this and then bring them to that experience, be very careful with that. Don't be coercive. It is necessary once in a while, the things that they're not aware of yet, to bring it into their view so they can see it. Okay. But to actually push somebody down some particular road is a very dangerous thing to do. And that's another thing, too, about our way. We've had times people bring up different kinds of programs, not just here, but in other places. Programs to support this kind of action and that kind of action or whatever. And will Dharma feel, well, we support this or we support that? And I remember like the time with my own teacher, Katagiri Roshi, when everybody was going to demonstrate. I mean, people over the city were going down here to Honeywell to demonstrate against, you know, their making of the cluster bombs, I believe it was. Yeah, horrible device that they were manufacturing. So people wanted to demonstrate. So this is not the thing to do, but Katagiri just pointed out, well, but you see that, of course, that's not so healthy. That's not good. But to then rile up more people, to make them angry. Of course, you rile up things, you get it on the news, more people find out about it. But what are you doing? You're perpetuating the very thing you say you want to stop. Making other people resentful of you. There's people that work there. They have their job there. Maybe they don't have any choice. They have a family to support. All kinds. This is a very complex human world. So very careful about what it is that we need to support. We always want to be proactive, you know, and engage and get out there and do something. Set up this program and do it this way and that way. But we don't understand that very kind of approach and that very action is taking as the fundamental understanding of the world that it's fragmented. Not that it is all of one piece. Of course, it has the appearance of being fragmented. But you're intensifying it through doing that. There is a different mind and a different way to live, which starts to soften those differences and those distinctions across which the hatred and misunderstandings and these kinds of things move. And again, this is a magnanimous mind, seeing things in this way. So this very proactive kind of thing, it's even in this wonderful rule, the golden rule. Here in Western philosophy and teaching, religious teaching, we find this way in the Bible. It's out of the Torah, I believe. Well, we all know it, right? Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And, of course, we know that there's a negative expression of this. We find it in the East. We find it in Confucius's Analects. It's in there somewhere, one of his aphorisms. Do not do unto someone else what you would not have done unto you. Well, of course, that is, we say that's the golden rule, but in negative form. And what's the difference? Negative, positive, you know, let's just make it positive, you know, since they're all the same. But if you look very carefully, it is not the same. The golden rule has been a big bugaboo in Western thought. Because there's problems with it. Seems pretty good. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. But what if what you would have done unto you is somebody to, you know, or to, just to get into fights? You know, I want to get into a fight with you, so I go around picking fights, you know, because I want to do unto others as I would have them do unto me, you know. And there's a number of different ways we could look at this. And then the different kinds of steps we'll go. Here's how we start making things complicated now. Remember Occam's razor? We'll start making things complicated. Trying to adjust this golden rule, all the while totally ignoring this negative form. Do not. See, we always feel like we have to do. Our way, our practice is about, you know, look at that and don't do that. There isn't something you need to do. It is already being done. What is that? Wake up to that and live with that. So if you just simply do not do unto others, and we can remember this when we're dealing with children or anyone else for that matter, do not do unto them what you would not have done unto you. So rather than being proscriptive and forward and positive, proactive, all of that, just lay off. Back out of that. Because the world is very active already. And if we can learn to see what that action is, what that natural action is, and we do clearly define that in Buddhist teaching, natural action as opposed to our own willed action, now we can find a way to live in peace and freedom and in a way that's compatible with reality without doing injury to others, whether children or anyone else for that matter. But this is a way that runs very counter to the way most of us think, particularly, I don't know if it's even particular to our culture really, anywhere, actually, I suspect. But it really runs counter because we want to get hold of, we want to take hold, we want to get in charge, we want to do something, we want to shape something, we want to force it and make it a particular way. What we don't understand is that the way our heart really sings to, and what we really want is just simply to be awake. And that involves just standing back a bit. Doesn't mean inaction, because there might be those times when it's required of you to act. So that's what we always think, well, if I don't go ahead and act, you know, but we're acting in a different way out of a different kind of mind, out of a different kind of insight and understanding. And it's one that's compatible with the way the world is. I know that this sounds strange, maybe even kind of disappointing, because we want to get out there and do. But our way is really, it's called not doing. But that's not exactly it either, because it's impossible. You know, there already is doing. So what it is, it's a matter of learning to see what the doing is, what is going on. And then learning to live in a way that's compliant with that, that's not defying it, that's not trying to reshape it. And through understanding that, it's through the understanding of that, that we finally can find this joyfulness and this magnanimity of mind, and this mind of kindness. And this mind that allows us to live in nature without trying to reconstruct nature in a way where if we're not very careful, it's going to just wipe us out. So this doesn't mean not doing. It the great teachers, they didn't just sit on their hands. They did something. And this teaching has come down to us. But it is difficult. It's not easy to see. It's simple, but it's not easy. But it does require that we reflect on this a bit. And this would show us this kind mind and parental mind. Okay, well, maybe I've said enough here. Do you have any questions about anything I said here today? Yes, Nancy.
The idea of emptying the cup.
Mm-hmm.
Without getting too conceptual, magnanimous mind and joyful mind and kind mind are there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So if we empty the cup, you see, that's our own agenda, our own story, our own selfish, egoistic ways. Our own agenda, even our agenda, well, I want to do good things. I want to help people. I want, and I'm a good person, and I want to stop war. And yes, okay. No, I just empty that. That's what our way is. You're right. Very acute observation. And that's really the case, that mind is already there. It's already pervasive. That's an aspect of this whole magnanimity of mind. We can find that. Our own personal mind can finally arrive at that and find that if we empty our cup. You know, if we just set down our thing, the thing that we're trying to push through. And now we can act out of this large mind, which is a joyful mind, and it is a kind mind. And it is a mind, and his kindness also is another way I could have talked of it, but it is a way of, well, it's compatible with reality. It allows functionality to take place in ways that aren't disruptive or injurious or confrontative and all of that. And that can be more of a, I don't want to say engaged, because the next thing you know, we've got ego back in there again. But it allows this kind of action then to take place. And that's kind of where the functionality of these three is going to be occurring in that area. Maybe just something for you to consider.
The hard part I have an understanding is the empty part. Open, I get.
Mm-hmm.
The empty is...
Well, in this case, we're talking about is like in the case of empty your cup. Empty is just, you know, to set down your agenda. And, you know, whatever it is that you're hanging on to something there and you want to put that through. You think that this is right and this is good. But if you can name it, if you can label it, that this is what we should do, this is what is right, I'll tell you that is delusional. Then as long as you hang on to that and then try to move something through, you are going to be causing injury. That is not the way to do this. Unfortunately, though, that's the thing that's so very graspable. So it's very easy for a mind to go to something like that, something that's been labeled, defined. That's what we want to do. We want to even get things kind of fixed in that way. The problem is, you see, that just doesn't match reality. Reality is never that way. So we bring our mind back into this open, spacious place. But now things are showing up, things are happening, and here it is where this functioning mind, now kind mind, can now begin to function. But it's functioning in as this magnanimous mind and joyful mind too. So even though the injustice is slung at you, but with a magnanimous mind, because we're not locked down into a tight, small, confined mind, we don't, no offense, no anger, no sense of wanting to get back. And I'm not even saying that any of us can live this way perfectly. I can't. But there is this kind of mind, and we can learn to bring our own mind to that. And how do we do that? By emptying the cup, by seeing how it is that we're hanging on to something. Start to get very clear, and to the extent that you continue to do that, that's embroiling you in pain, suffering, difficulty, and confusion. And there's no understanding there. When you start to get a sense of that, then we can start to recognize that more and more. We kind of loosen our grip on all of that and let it drop. I know of no one who perfectly carries that out. And that's not even really the point. But so often we're just completely caught up with our thing, and it hasn't even occurred to us that there's a whole other way of approaching all of this. That's what I'm pointing out here. Yes?
If the Buddha would find a natural way to deal with problems.
Well, yeah. Yeah, well, they don't find it, but they see it. They understand it. I mean, that's what a Buddha is. A Buddha is one who realizes this and then who can live out of this. A Buddha is not a particular person. A Buddha is not some kind of persona or whatever that's going to descend on you or me or somebody else and, oh, no, I'm a Buddha, you know, something like this. And in fact, actually, already, this is Buddha right here, all of us. You're Buddha. My teacher used to always say, you are Buddha, is he? But we don't really, what's the problem here? Well, it's because we're confused. And we're not seeing what this is. So a Buddha, then a one who manifests as a Buddha, who in this moment they realize what's going on. There is this moment where finally we see it, maybe for the first time, and we say, well, that's enlightenment. But there's really nothing actually transformed here other than the mind is kind of cleared up. But very quickly, it all come falling back in, huh? And the next thing you know, we're... But once we've seen that, we can find our way back to that. And gradually, little by little, more and more, we can learn to live out of that. Even though I don't know of anyone who can do that continuously. Remember, my teacher used to say that he was hoping he could live to be 70. Unfortunately, he didn't, but he thought maybe by the time he was 70, he could begin to kind of live out of this a little bit. Yeah. So we just cultivate a mind and cultivate a mind. And never mind how long it's going to take for all you're doing now. You know, just in the next moment, if you catch yourself in some embroilment there, well, just drop that. And the entanglements, and just come back. That's what we need to do. But first we need to realize that there is this way, that there is this mind, there is something here to bring our attention to, find out what that is. It's not a particular, that's why I can't just hold and say, well, think this or do that. It isn't something like that. It's more a matter of just attending to what you're doing. Notice how you're caught. Enlightenment is nothing more than realizing what you're doing. Realizing how you're caught. When you see the pain of that, the confusion of that, you know, all of that, the dukkha, well, it's much easier to just let that go. Why am I persisting in this? Of course, for a long time, we identify with the confused thought that we have, the anger, the injustice, whatever. You know, we form our identity out of that. Yeah, and it's very difficult to really see that for what it is. What are you carrying that on for? Why? It's only injuring you, you know, really. Well, of course, you can use that to, you know, further entangle others as well. But when we start to see that, after a while, you start playing that game. But the first thing we need to realize is that there's a radically different, I don't even want to say approach. It's not an approach. We don't go somewhere. You can do this right now. Just come back and realize what's going on here. And stop talking to yourself. Don't label things and identify things. Oh, I see. Well, I'm just... No, that's part of the confusion, you see. To see it for what it is. This comes up, that's pain. You're talking to yourself there. You're holding something, whatever. And there's, you know, the pain is already in that. Just see that. And then you can just stop doing that. See? And there's nothing to say about it. There's nothing to get hold of here, really. Well, this is a magnanimous mind, which is also kind mind. Because now when you act, it's kindness, acting out of kindness. And that kindness doesn't have boundaries, it's just limited to my kind or my kin, which is also related to this. No, it's unbounded. If it's truly magnanimous mind, then it's acting in this way that we otherwise might think we would just limit to those that are close to us. No, this mind now, because it's magnanimous mind, it is unbounded. And it is joyful mind. It registers in the moment and in your own mind is kind of a quiet joy. not a silly, grinning kind of joy or anything, but just a quiet joy, peacefulness. Yes?
You know, mostly when I hear the word kindness, I think of respect and taking care and people aware and all these other things, and thinking of the other person first and extending myself and all these things.
Yeah, that's not actual kindness. It's because you're still seeing the world fragmented. There's me, and I will be kind to you. You know, things are still boxed up, you see. So that's not really what we're speaking of here, then, in terms of true kindness. Because to the extent that we've limited our kindness in that way, well, yeah, there's could very well be unkindness over here as a result of that, you see. Or even with what we're thinking is kindness, but it's my agenda. It's my, you know, my identity. I'm a good person. I need to go over and be kind to those people, help those people. But what is it? I'm just acting out of ego. And then what if I'm kind of rebuffed or something? Do I take offense? Or am I disappointed? Do I start crying? You know what? See, these are just all entanglements, you see. So what I'm speaking of is recognizing that rat's nest of, well, I don't want to disparage rats, but just all that tangled mess, you see. Recognize that for what it is, the entanglements. Recognize when you find your mind getting caught in those ways, you will see yourself holding to something, you know, and you will see yourself. You will see the self forming here. And you might begin to recognize that dukkha, that pain that's in that.
So kindness is really complete
openness. Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. It's not keeping any kind of score. But it is this matter of one of the things will show is that yeah, you are not treating others in a way that you would not be treated yourself. And that's different than having it on your agenda that I'm going to do to others what I would like done for me. No, that's not kind. That's you. That's your agenda. That's not the same thing as the negative formulation. They are not the same. Yes, Catherine.
Along those lines, can you speak a little bit about the difference between freedom and license? Because I think when we're in our dealing with children,
yeah,
it comes up often that if we say we should give them freedom.
But yeah. Excellent point. Yeah, freedom isn't license just to do anything. So when I spoke of freedom, like Suzuki Roshi in his book Zen Mind Beginner's Mind, he said, was it about the horse? Give your horse a large pasture, he said. Meaning that you don't put real tight restrictions, you see, so the horse feels free. But still, it's in a corral, it's in a pasture. So we want to let the child be free, but now we watch. And that's kind of the corral. And then when the conflict arises or there's some confusion in the child's mind, acting out of some kind of confusion here that's causing pain for the child or for someone else, or okay, now, in a very kind way, we can maybe say something to help them realize what they're doing. In a non-judgmental way, not accusatory way, help them to see that. And of course, they might not see it, not right away, but little by little. That's what and it requires enormous patience, constantly coming back to this. But yes, so the things need to be done. You know, freedom doesn't mean free to do whatever I feel like doing. That's not real freedom. Freedom, as we understand it in Buddhism, is that it's freedom of mind, meaning that the mind isn't preformed with certain kinds of ideas. This is the old empty your cup image once again, that actually we do empty it. Maybe temporarily we will hold a particular form or idea, always ready to set that down, realizing the traps and snares that come with everything that's like that. But this would be freedom of mind then, is that you are free to act out of this in this way. But it certainly doesn't mean you can, because the moment you do something that causes injury or difficulty, that's not an expression of freedom. That's an expression of bondage. So there is a distinction here to be made. But the distinction is quite subtle, not easily seen. Thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.